Good morning. It's 11 minutes before the hour. You're listening to NPR's Morning Edition over Raven Radio, KCAW in Sitka. 40 degrees downtown at the Cable House this morning, windy and warmer. It is Monday, November 21st, 2011. I'm Robert Woolsey with Raven News. A Coast Guard Air Station Sitka helicopter crew rescued two men from a capsized skiff 28 miles southwest of Sitka on Saturday. Coast Guard Sector Juneau Command Center received a report from the men early Saturday afternoon that their 15-foot skiff was taking on water. Air Station Sitka launched a helicopter shortly thereafter. The rescue crew arrived on scene a little after 2 p.m., just as the skiff capsized. The rescue swimmer was deployed and helped hoist the two men. They were flown to Sitka and safely transferred to awaiting emergency medical services at 3 p.m. in stable condition, with no reported injuries. Their names have not yet been released. The men maintained radio contact with the Coast Guard throughout the rescue. Because both men had on the proper safety gear when the vessel capsized, they were able to stay afloat long enough for the rescue swimmer to rescue them, said Petty Officer First Class Chris Harkins, a watchstander with Sector Juneau. The Coast Guard would like to remind all mariners to check the weather before getting underway. The weather at the time of the rescue was reported as winds of 45 miles per hour with 8-foot seas. One of the challenges of living in remote Alaska is easy access to fresh food, such as produce. But that's not the case at the school in Tenneke Springs, where every day the students get a meal that goes above and beyond the usual cafeteria fare. KCAW's Ed Ronco had lunch recently with the 10 students at Tenneke School.
All right, grown-ups, remember school lunch? You know, the mashed potatoes served with an ice cream scoop, the hairnets, the stuff that wanted to be pizza when it grew up? Well, the students who are growing up now in Tenneke Springs will have very different memories of the middle of the school day. They'll remember meat and potato croquettes, or chicken a la king, or any of the myriad of foods that are part of the Tenneke Springs school lunch program.
I don't think what we're cooking is any different than what you guys do in Sitka or whatever. I think what makes it unusual, like I say, is the availability of fresh produce.
That's Wendy Stern, who shares cooking duties a week on, a week off, with Susan Lee, a trained chef who travels to Juneau every other week and comes back with a lot of produce. Some of it is on the cutting board that sits right in front of Stern.
So we've got some mushrooms for the salad here?
Yep, mushrooms, tomatoes, mushrooms. There will be some out there that will pick these mushrooms right out of their salad. Others that used to pick mushrooms out of their salad and now eat them. So you see headway is being made. Try to chop them up small so that I hide them.
While some of the produce comes from Juneau, a lot of the vegetables come from local farmer Dale Zeal. The community has a fairly active local food scene, and besides her duties at the school, Stern helps organize a farmer's market here in the summer. She says people in Tenneke take their produce seriously.
It's only in Tenneke that I've heard of, you know, broccoli wars.
Broccoli wars?
Oh, absolutely.
As in?
People won't speak to each other if someone takes too much broccoli and it's the beginning of broccoli season. Or someone wipes out the peas and you're the next in line and all the peas are gone. We're talking major bad feelings about stuff like
that. For real?
For real. Oh, it's the real deal. Yeah.
There are no wars allowed in the line at Tenneke School, where the students are given carefully measured portions of food in accordance with USDA guidelines. Parent Shauna Harper says that's part of the reason the program exists.
We decided to do it because we wanted to ensure that our kids were getting healthy food during the day.
Harper helped start the school lunch program about 3 years ago. Produce isn't the only thing that comes from local sources. So does protein. It's not unusual for the school to get a hold of a fish someone's caught or some local venison. Harper says processing those things correctly takes a little extra work.
But it also means that we're not feeding our kids, you know, beef that we don't know where it came from and chicken that could be questionable. I mean, they're eating a lot of fresh fish and venison as well.
Harper says it's important to teach the building blocks of a healthy diet, but that the lunch program also fosters a sense of community.
There's a lot of camaraderie with it because they all sit down in a family style setting and they joke and they laugh and they really enjoy lunch together as one big group.
Lunch is served under the atrium at the center of the school. It's taco pie with a fresh green salad today. Seventh grader Quinn Keel says he likes the lunches here.
It's less like fast food and more like food, I guess.
He says the menu changes a lot, which is nice, and that students can put in special requests on birthdays.
Or if everyone begs hard enough, long enough, we'll eventually get it.
Keel says he's easy to please, so it's hard to pick a favorite.
Yeah, I pretty much eat everything, so... Yeah. Some people, they don't like stir fry, but...
Yeah. But you're cool with most of it.
Yeah. Like some of it I like more than other things, but I basically eat everything, so yeah.
With 10 palates to please, you'd think organizing the menus would be difficult.
You know, I love it.
That's Susan Lee, the trained chef who oversees the program. She also teaches cooking to the students and introduces them to world cuisines. Lee says the students fill out surveys at the beginning of the year about the things they like and the things they don't like.
And then I just warn them that, well, everybody likes something different and doesn't like something different, so we're going to have at least one thing throughout the year that you won't like.
She says most of them try everything and eat everything, and that they have pretty sophisticated palates.
The biggest thing is for kids to enjoy food and enjoy cooking and be interested in it, know where it came from, know the history of it.
And that, says Lee, teaches them to be smart eaters now and hopefully for the rest of their lives. For AK, I'm Ed Ronco in Tenneke Springs.
Alaska and Canadian scientists are among a large group of experts hoping to convince the British Columbia government to study the cumulative effects of proposed development in the transboundary region. In a letter sent last week to BC Premier Christy Clark, 36 scientists say industrialization spurred by construction of BC Hydro's Northwest Transmission Line threatens the area. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander has more.
The 287 kilovolt Northwest Transmission Line will stretch 214 miles north from the Skeena substation near Terrace, British Columbia. The BC Hydro project will provide reliable economic power to communities and resource development. The power line has touched off what Dr. Jim Pojar of Smithers, BC, calls a gold rush mentality in the transboundary region. At least 11 mines, coal bed methane, and 18 hydroelectric projects are proposed for the Canadian side.
There's no complete assessment of what could happen if all of them get developed, you know, within 5 or 10 years.
Pojar is one of the scientists who have signed on to the letter. They say the Stikine, Iskuk, and Unuk rivers, important to both sides of the border, are the most vulnerable. To the north, the scientists believe the Taku River is already threatened by the existing Tulsiqua Chief Mine at its BC headwaters. It's an impressive list of PhD-level scientists. Dr. Jack Stanford of the University of Montana at Missoula is among them.
That's a very broad cross-section of the scientific expertise of the United States and Canada.
Stanford says that should carry some weight with the politicians.
If it doesn't, it just means that the disconnect between science and government is more profound than we think. We want them to listen to this.
The scientist's letter requests a transparent ecosystem-based approach for assessing new development in the transboundary watersheds. Pojar says it's the sum total of the projects that have them worried. While environmental impact statements will be done for individual mines, no one knows the effect of 5 or 10 mines in a region. A forest ecologist, Pojar has spent a lot of time in the transboundary area. He says big chunks of the watersheds are still fearsomely wild.
This isn't just another piece of northern bush. Sometimes we who live up north kind of take it for granted, the landscape we live in, but, you know, on a continental scale, this is just incredible.
The transboundary rivers support all 5 species of Pacific salmon that sustain Alaska and British Columbia commercial sport and subsistence fisheries. Dr. K.V. Koski of Juneau has studied southeast Alaska's rivers, including many years on the Taku. The habitat restoration specialist spent 30 years with the National Marine Fisheries Service at the Auk Bay Lab.
All those transboundary rivers basically are the same type of system, you know, and they rely on so much of the wood and debris in those areas for forming the habitats and maintaining the channels and the sloughs and things like that.
Koski says hundreds of thousands of salmon rear every year in the lower Taku River in Alaska.
The majority of the juveniles actually come downstream from the Canadian waters and rear in the United States side. So it's really important that those habitats are protected.
Stanford calls the transboundary rivers the primary salmon producers of North America.
And most of them are entirely intact, not influenced by much of any activity other than harvest of fish. and thus they're the last best places for fish, particularly salmon.
The BC Environmental Assessment Office is responsible for evaluating mining, energy, and transportation projects for the province. A recent Auditor General's report indicates the EAO is erratic when it comes to monitoring and enforcement. If that's the case, the scientists say, the BC government cannot assure environmental protection at the headwaters of the transboundary rivers or downstream in Alaska. They say even if only some of the proposed development happens, it could transform the ecological landscape of the region. In Juneau, I'm Rose Marie Alexander.
A master's degree program in business administration will end at the University of Alaska Southeast. School of Management Interim Dean John Blanchard says the program has seen a decline in enrollment and does not have the critical mass needed to continue. He says the MBA program needs at least 25 students to run efficiently. The program catered to working professionals and was done by distance learning. UA Fairbanks and UA Anchorage offer MBA programs on campus. Blanchard says seven master's candidates who enrolled this year will be the last MBA class at the campus based in Juneau. Freezing temperatures continue to grip interior Alaska, with the Fairbanks area in the midst of five straight days of minus 35 or colder temperatures. That's a record for the month of November, which previously had only been two straight days of 35 degrees below zero or lower. Sunday's coldest temperature was minus 47 in Tok. The National Weather Service also reported minus 41 in North Pole, 38 below at Eielson Air Force Base, and minus 41 at North Pole. Zone weather forecast for Sitka and Port Alexander today calls for wind and rain. Highs around 40, east winds 20 to 30 miles per hour with gusts to 40 miles per hour. This is KCAW in Sitka.